Mike Rowe here with a few thoughts on my favorite sweatshirt, a classic zip-up hoodie that used to be navy blue but has since faded to what the fashionistas call a distressed indigo. It's 13 years old, soft as a flannel bathrobe, and after a few hundred dirty jobs, demonstrably and undeniably indestructible. This is the kind of sweatshirt girlfriends like to permanently borrow, but I've held on to this one because I got it from American Giant. American Giant makes all their stuff right here in the USA so they can control every link in their own supply chain. That matters, because when you buy American Giant, you not only get great quality, you create jobs for people in factory towns all over the country. No pressure, but if you give a damn about the business of making things in America, you got to support the companies who are doing it right. Go to American-Giant.com/Mike to get 20% off your first order. That's American-Giant.com/Mike.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Tom Butler.
And I'm Brendan Duffy.
You're listening to the James Bond A to Z podcast.
Join us on this journey of discovery across the world of the 007 movies as we take an encyclopedic look at cinema's greatest spy films.
We'll learn about the people who made them in front of the camera and behind, from Ken Adam to Mac Zorin, with the occasional detour down a few rabbit holes. And we'll sometimes be joined by guests with unique insight into the world of Bond.
This podcast is in no way affiliated with the James Bond brand, Eon, or the Fleming Estate. We do our best to make sure the information is accurate, but sometimes we do get it wrong. If you want to correct us on something or add some more detail, email us on podcast@jamesbondatoz.co.uk.
Thanks for listening. We hope you enjoy the show. Hello and welcome to the James Bond A to Z podcast, where we have reached the letter R. My name is Tom Butler, and joining me as we research and regurgitate the characters and creators of the James Bond world that fall under the 18th letter of the alphabet, it's the really, really, really ridiculously righteous Mr. Brendan Duffy.
You've ran out of ideas, haven't you?
Yes, it's the letter R, if you haven't guessed already by me saying it many, many times. So interestingly, the letter R has actually served up a real raft of rarities. And there's lots of many names that you may never have come across before. So buckle up. I think this is an episode of real deep cuts. What do you think, Brendan?
Yeah, it's quite interesting how it's fallen, isn't it? The characters, like the two Bond girls, chronologically in there. That's pretty interesting. And of course, we could have had a Bond film, Risiko.
But it never came to be, or it may still yet come to be. We might have to come back to this in a future episode. Who knows? I do. Before we kick off with the letter R, I've got to confess to a serious oversight. For the episode for the letter P, we missed a certain Mr. Tom Pevsner, who you may or may not know, but he was a German-born filmmaker. He was an associate, then an executive producer on every James Bond film from Your Eyes Only to GoldenEye. So I've just got to say apologies to Tom Pevsner and his legacy, but you get an honourable mention here in the letter R. Pevsner was someone that was hired by Cubby to keep For Your Eyes Only cost effective. And John Glenn said of Pevsner, he was my nuts and bolts man on all my Bond films. His experience was and support were invaluable to my success. And like I said, GoldenEye was his last Bond credit. And Barbara Broccoli said that Tom Pevsner was a mentor to her, and she learned the art of production scheduling from him. He taught me about breaking down scripts. He was an incredible man. So apologies, Mr. Pevsner, but hopefully just this token gesture will keep the Bond fans happy and off our backs. So that, you know. Do you want to give a shout out for our underappreciated movie moments?
Yeah, so we're still looking for those underappreciated movie moments to celebrate the 60th anniversary of the Bond movies. So if you can send us an audio clip, how are we taking those?
Just by email. Send them on email to podcast@jamesbondaz.co.uk. And yeah, try and keep them under 2 minutes long and try and get them to us by the middle of September 2022. Obviously, if you're listening to this in the future, you've missed your chance. But try and get them to this middle of September so we can put them into an episode in October. We've had some really great entries, but yes, we need more. We'd love to hear what you think. So now is your chance. If you like the show and you want to get involved, send them over. Loads of great underappreciated moments you can choose from. So from underappreciated moments, Brendan, to
R is for R. The character, the assistant to Q in The World Is Not Enough, technician and employed by Q Branch. He first appears in The World Is Not Enough, and then he appears again in Die Another Day. This time, is he as Q, or is it just Quartermaster?
No, I think doesn't the scene evolve so that by the end, Pierce Brosnan's Bond calls him Q because he sort of accepts that he is the real Q. You haven't mentioned who plays him yet, though.
No, John Cleese.
John Cleese, yes.
Yes. So it was quite a short stint for R/Q, but he did also star in the video game Agent Under Fire. No, he did the advertising for Agent Under Fire. You can see that advert on YouTube. And he actually posted it last year as well. Just he wants to know if anyone actually played the game. Oh. And he posted a clip of the advert. And it's just John Cleese asking about various gadgets. Like, what have you done with this? And stuff like that. But he did actually appear in some video games, The World Is Not Enough video game, and Everything or Nothing. So in terms of getting the role, John Cleese said, "I could never understand why they passed me over for the lead role of James Bond, but they did. Movie after movie, they came up with old grandfathers like Roger Moore when they wanted people who were dynamic and sexy like me." And just a side note here, this is one of the all-time greatest British comedians saying this. He said, "So when they said, 'Would you like to be Q's assistant R?' I couldn't have been more pleased." So, yeah, the reason they asked is because at the time, Cleese's wife, I don't know what number wife that would be, he was friends with the producers. So that got him the role. And he said, "We agreed that Desmond Llewellyn would go on being Q until he was 100, at which point I would be 80. So obviously, we've talked about Q in the previous episode. The plan wasn't for Desmond Llewellyn to retire. It was just they'd given him an assistant. But obviously, sadly, he passed away. He died in a car accident after the release of The World Isn't Enough. So then John Cleese took over the role of Q for Die Another Day. And in terms of the playing the role, he said they're very, very happy to let you play a bit with the script. He said, "So that and Shrek are about the two of the best jobs you can have." Just to let you know the level we're dealing with here. So John Cleese, who's not heard of John Cleese, right? John Cleese, born October 1939, is an English actor, comedian, screenwriter and producer. So most famous for either Monty Python, which he created in the late 60s.
Co-created.
Don't worry, I'm going to credit them. Co-created with Terry Gilliam, Eric Idle, Terry Jones, Michael Palin and Graham Chapman. And they made films as well. So it wasn't just the TV show. They also did Monty Python, The Holy Grail, Life of Brian and The Meaning of Life, which has fans globally. And it's a huge phenomenon.
Still a huge phenomenon, yeah.
Yeah, not for me. But, you know, but this is for me. In the mid-70s, he wrote a sitcom with his first wife, Connie Booth, who played Polly, and he played Basil Fawlty in Fawlty Towers.
Iconic.
Which, you know, is in all of those lists of the greatest sitcoms ever. And did it win, or did Only Fools win?
What's that, the greatest sitcom ever?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it has been named that. I think it has been named that. So you're a massive Fawlty Towers fan, but you don't like Monty Python?
Yeah.
Wow.
Just can't relate to swords and soldiers.
I don't know what that means, but go on.
No, it's Holy Grail, isn't it?
Knights.
Well, as I can relate to a miserable hotel owner.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That's just one part of Monty Python, isn't it? But
all right, the Jesus-y bits.
What about the TV series? Anyway, look, we digress. Let's get back
to
art.
The dead parrot's good.
The dead parrot stuff, yeah.
It won a BAFTA for Best Entertainment Performance in 1980. And then since that, he made A Fish Called Wanda in 1988.
A classic.
With fellow Python Michael Palin.
Yeah.
And Fierce Creatures. I think I've seen A Fish Called Wanda, but not Fierce Creatures. Should I have?
Yeah. No, Fierce Creatures is not as good. I mean, I think they were hoping to recapture the magic of Fish Called Wanda, but didn't quite manage it.
And yeah, he wrote both of those. A Fish Called Wanda was nominated for an Oscar for Best Original Screenplay. He's also in Time Bandits. He also did Rat Race. I'm sure we remember that one. Yeah. He was nearly Headless Nick in the Harry Potter films, and he was in four of the Shrek films as the king, I think.
Right, okay.
One of his favourite roles, apparently, so there you go. He also did a walk-on part playing a man on the beach who looks like John Cleese in Bullseye. And who was in Bullseye?
Roger Moore.
And Michael Caine.
And Michael Caine.
So yeah, that's our... for anyone who was waiting during the Q episode going, where's John Cleese? Well, there he is. We've done him now. Stop emailing in.
What do you think of John Cleese as our...
I mean, it would only work in those two films.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
I think any other is out of place.
It's very broad, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I think that's the problem. I think with Q, as we've done a whole episode on Q recently, I think the thing with Q is that... there's that relationship with Bond, isn't it? He takes his work very seriously. He doesn't like the agents messing around and stuff. But with R, it kind of, with it being Cleese as a comedy actor.
Yeah,
it lent too heavily into the comedy side of things. Mm-hmm.
So, well, for me, it was John Cleese playing John Cleese.
Yeah, that's
it. Wasn't Q.
No, that's true.
That's the problem.
Yeah, that's fair. I know but people do like his incarnation of Q, but and if you get something out of it, then fair play to you. Horses for courses at the end of the day. But why didn't he come back in Casino Royale? But John Cleese, I mean, to say he's a problematic figure nowadays is probably probably on the money. Should we move on?
Yes, please.
Right. R is for Rietti, Robert Rietti. Now, you probably won't know the name, but you'll know the voice. Cryptic. So, born in February 1923, he died in April 2015. Lucio Herbert Rietti, who was known as Robert Rietti, was an English actor, voice actor, and playwright who really made his name in the world of ADR, or as we know it, dubbing. Now, his fingerprints, or at least his voice, is all over the early James Bond films. But you just might not have known how much. There's a really, really great clip on YouTube, which I'll probably put out on Twitter, from a Barry Norman TV show where he does a segment on Robert Rietti. And Barry Norman calls him the man of a thousand voices. And who are we to dispute that with Barry Norman? So across the Bond films, he voiced Strangways in Dr. No. He voiced Emilio Largo in Thunderball. So when you see Adolfo Celli talking, it's Rob Rietti. He voices Tiger Tanaka in You Only Live Twice and Blofeld in For Your Eyes Only, or the person that's supposed to be Blofeld. So he has the line about the stainless steel, deli and stainless steel. But he also appeared on screen in Honor Majesty's Secret Service in the casino scene as well. And he worked on a total of 8 Bond films. And he also, I think, I couldn't get full confirmation of this, but I think he directed a lot of the post-production syncing across the Bond films as well. he once said in nearly every Bond picture, there's been a foreign villain. And in almost every case, they've used my voice. So just a little bit of a biog on Robert Rietti. His father, Victor Rietti, was also an actor, and he recognised his son's talent from the age of 8. He'd given him a script to help him learn his lines, and he realised that his son had completely memorised the lines while he was rehearsing. And this sort of was a catapult into an early life as a child actor for Robert Rietti. And his IMDb credits, I mean, there are literally hundreds. They begin in 1933. He went to his father's own stage school, and he was handpicked by Alfred Hitchcock to play a boy in Secret Agent in 1936, but he had to turn it down due to the laws about the schooling that he would have needed at the time while he was filming. So he'd done like dozens of films by the time he was aged 11, but when World War II broke out, because his family was Italian, they were placed in a detention center. But after 8 months, they were released and they were allowed to organise a troop of actors who were then went on to entertain the troops. It's funny how many people in the Bond world, that is some, a part of what happened to them, isn't it?
Yeah.
But yeah, like I said, he was a very in-demand child actor. And that then evolved into being a screen actor. A lot of the time working in character roles. He's got some really good credits to his name, though. The Italian Job, he's in that in 1969. Sunday Bloody Sunday in 1971. He's in The Omen and in the 2001 Hannibal film as well. After the war, he worked with Orson Welles a fair bit. He appeared in a few radio plays with him. And then later in 1972, when Orson Welles starred in Treasure Island, there was a problem with the recording and Orson Welles wasn't able to come back to do it. So he recorded all of Orson Welles' dialogue in 1972's Treasure Island. And basically you wouldn't know the difference, but it became known as the, sort of the king of dubs and often was called on to supply like Italian voices, but he also spoke fluent German, French and Russian. And he became sort of well known for dubbing foreign actors in English language films with international casts, films such as Lawrence of Arabia, El Cid. But due to the nature of this role, he has many, many uncredited roles across movie, radio and TV. And people who know like dubbing voices apparently can recognise Robert Rietti's voice instantly. He said, I don't really understand why, and this was talking about why he didn't get credits, but because if they want singing in a film and they have an actress or an actor who doesn't sing well, they'll revoice them with a famous voice and there'll be a credit afterwards. But if they revoice a voice for speaking, nobody must know. There was an actor, a famous actor called Jack Hawkins, who had cancer and had part of his larynx removed. And then Robert Rietti became the man who did his voice in every movie. In the film Waterloo in 1970, he did many, many voices. And there's a scene he did 98 voices in that movie, and there's a scene where there's four of him doing four voices on screen at the same time. It's kind of crazy, really. And in the film Agatha Christie film And Then There Were None, there are scenes where he's having conversations with himself across characters.
Wow. I wonder how he recorded that.
Back and forth. Yeah. And then bringing it back to Bond, in 1979, after the death of Robert Shaw, he recorded his dialogue for the film Avalanche Express, because the actor had died before he'd been able to do the dubbing. He's a very well established film creative. He was known also for translating and adapting Italian plays into English, and he was actually awarded a knighthood by the Italian government and was given a BAFTA in 2000 for his a special award for his outstanding work. In 2010, he published an autobiography called A Forehead Pressed Against a Window, which I'm going to pick up now because it's available quite readily. But one final fun Bond fact for you. Appearing in Never Say Never Again as an Italian minister, he's the only actor beyond Sean Connery to appear in both Never Say Never Again and Thunderball.
Wow.
So there you go. Robert Rietti, an unsung hero of the Bond world.
R is for Rider. Honey Rider. So in the novel, it's Honeychild Rider, and then they shortened the name, changed it to Honey Rider for the film. Played by Swiss actor Ursula Andress. But speaking of dubbing, she was also dubbed by Nikki van der Zyl, who have we covered? No,
because it's saving it for the letter Z.
Oh, yes, we need something for that. And in terms of the dubbing, she said, it bothered me at the time, but I worked hard to improve my English for future roles. And looking back, it probably did me a favor. So yeah, Honey Rider is, she is the child of a marine biologist. She was brought up by her father, who was then killed. He's killed, right, isn't he?
Yeah, well, I mean, she's an orphan, isn't she? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So yeah, she's an orphan, and she's basically learned everything she knows from an encyclopedia, which gives her that sort of innocent, positive outlook, but still doesn't trust Bond, does she, when she meets Bond?
And rightly so.
Yeah. So then obviously Bond sort of, I guess he can't shake her off, can he? So she ends up tagging along for the rest of the film, and then going to Crab Key and defeating Dr. No, and she's there and she's involved and she gets tied up. I feel it's very unfair what happens to her, isn't it, actually?
Yeah. She's only on the beach collecting the shells, isn't
collecting
she?
Shells,
she gets
yeah.
dragged into the story because of, Dr. No's men spot her on the radar and that's how they sort of come to find Bond, isn't
it? Yeah, and then she can't leave because her boat's destroyed.
Yeah, that's it.
So Ursula Andress, who plays Honey Rider, she was actually mentioned in an Ian Fleming novel. Do you know which one?
On Her Majesty's Secret Service.
Correct. And described as a beautiful movie star, along with the only other person to have been named who was also in a Bond film was David Niven.
Oh, and they got there eventually.
Yeah. So in terms of that scene, the iconic scene where she comes out of the sea with the shells, it's been homaged twice more by the franchise. First by Halle Berry in the 20th film, Die Another Day, for the anniversary. And then by Bond himself, Casino Royale, Daniel Craig comes out in his famous blue trunks. Ursula Andress, she talks about her legacy as a Bond girl, and she said, it was a big moment for me. I think that simple bikini made a complete difference to my career. It made me into a success. I had a few movies before that, but nothing had the impact of that scene in Dr. No. After being the first Bond girl, I had offer after offer and could take my pick of the roles that were around. It's a mystery. All I did was wear this bikini in Dr. No, not even a small one, and whoosh, overnight I made it. It gave me financial independence and changed my life completely. So in terms of that bikini, that it sold for £41,000, which was seven times the amount she was paid for her appearance.
Oh,
which is pretty incredible. And they had to learn the song Underneath the Mango Tree for that scene. And Sean Connery and Ursula Andress would fight over the record player because they only had one. So they'd fight over it too. And she said, he didn't need the practice because he sings much better than I do. I can't carry a tune.
And then she got dubbed.
It's not going to do a lot for her confidence, is it? So Ursula Andress, she went to school in Bern, in Switzerland, till she was 16. So she speaks French, German, Italian, and English. In terms of her career, so she was at a party where she met a producer who offered her a screen test for an Italian film, which was successful. So she got walk-on parts. And then eventually a Hollywood executive persuaded her to go to Hollywood and try out there. So she got to Hollywood in 1955 and she signed a contract, 7-year contract with Paramount, which is pretty good, isn't it, as soon as you get there. But it didn't result in any acting roles because she was reluctant to learn English. So that hampered her at the time. She also received a slight bit of fame because she dated James Dean just before he died.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And then she stayed on in Hollywood. She married John Derrick in 1957. So their plan was to make a film, but that didn't turn out either. So Dr. No, obviously that was her big break. Like she says, changed her life overnight. Following that, she played the female lead in an Elvis Presley musical called Fun in Acapulco. Have you seen that?
No.
No. So that's, I mean, what a huge job to get off the back of Bond. And then in 1963, she was in Four for Texas alongside Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, and Anita Ekberg.
Wow.
So, you know, that role really had propelled her forward. She was in, so she played a supporting role in What's New Pussycat, produced by Charles K. Feldman.
Here we go.
What else did he produce? Casino Royale, 1967. Ursula Andress, she played Vesper Lynn, and she's the spy who persuades Evelyn Tremble to carry out a mission. Evelyn Tremble is played by Peter Sellers. Her fee was apparently £200,000.
Wow.
Which was loads. Val Guest, who directed Andress's scenes in Casino Royale, said, "I don't think I've ever met someone who is so universally loved by everyone in a studio. They'd all do anything for her, and this is really quite something. One day someone is going to get the real Ursula on the screen and in a comedy, and she's going to astound everybody. The trouble is that she's so tense." I actually think she's quite good in that.
I thought she was pretty good, yeah.
Yeah, there's not many good things about that film, but I think she's one of them. Then she was in an Italian film called Anyone Can Play, 1968, and that was starring alongside Claudine Alga, another Bond girl.
Thunderball.
And then her career throughout the 70s, most of the roles she did, she was nude. And she earned her nickname. What do you think her nickname was?
Ursula Andress.
Yes. How original. 1981, she was in Clash of the Titans. She played Aphrodite alongside Laurence Olivier. And then since the 90s, she's all but retired. It's sort of really not rare appearances. And she splits her time between an apartment in Rome and a house in Switzerland. And that's nearby to her family. I think she's 86. There we go.
Evenings.
The first Bond girl.
Oh, exactly. I was just going to say, in terms of like...
Well, Sylvia Trench, but...
Yeah. But in terms of what you expect or what became expected of a Bond girl, mm-hmm. you know, yep. she really set the template for what was to come in the future. Mm-hmm. And that introduction scene is indelible, isn't it? Along with Rogers, along with Sean Connery's in that film, and Dr. No's, it's a great film with great introductions of characters, I think.
Yeah.
Like you say, with copies cropping up down the line, many, many times.
Absolutely.
Coffee, medium sweet. 2 medium sweet.
Thanks for listening. We hope you're enjoying the James Bond A to Z podcast. Remember, if you want to support the show, we have a Ko-fi page at ko-fi.com/JamesBondA-Z, where you can buy us a coffee for just £3 or for £3 a month. Thanks for listening. Back to the show.
Is that all it does?
So from one iconic character to another.
Here we go.
Artist for Robinson, Charles Robinson. Now, appearing in 3 Bond films, Charles Robinson is a MI6 aide and the deputy chief of staff who appears in Tomorrow Never Dies, The World Is Not Enough, and Die Another Day, portrayed by British actor Colin Salmon. Now, he joined the Tomorrow Never Dies, he was added to the story for Tomorrow Never Dies because Michael Kitchen's Bill Tanner was unable to return. He'd appeared in GoldenEye but wasn't available for Tomorrow Never Dies. So they had to basically swap a character in. And this is where Charles Robinson came from. He appears in the pre-title sequence of Tomorrow Never Dies. He's sort of briefing Bond over the radio when Bond is at the arms bazaar. And then he's also in the briefing in the back of the car with Bond. Then he appears again in The World Is Not Enough. Am I right in thinking Tanner comes back in that? Tanner does come back, doesn't he? So you have Tanner and Robinson. I can't remember if that's World Is Not Enough or Die Another Day. But anyway, he is basically by M's side the entire time of The World Is Not Enough. He goes out with her to the King Pipeline. There is one moment where basically he leaves her on her own and she gets kidnapped. So Robinson. Then Robinson returns in Die Another Day. He's there with Falco and the NSA agents on the Korean border when Bond is handed back. And then Robinson sadly gets shot and killed. Not really in the VR training sequence where Bond fails to protect M in Die Another Day. It's only a simulation, though. So Robinson lives to see the end of the movie, and he's there when they brief Bond and Jinx in the US base before they, whatever happens at the end of Die Another Day. I can't even remember what happened.
Power suit in a
the power aeroplane. Suit in the airplane, yeah. So there's all that. Anyway, Colin Salmon. He was born in the early 60s in Bethnal Green, but he grew up in Luton. Now, I didn't know this about Colin Salmon, but he's a very keen musician. And he's been in a lot of bands, including a punk band called Friction. And nowadays, he plays trumpet in his own jazz quartet. Did you know that?
No.
He's played at lots of different venues, one of them being the Cheltenham Jazz Festival. That's because that is thanks to Dame Judi Dench being the president of the Cheltenham Jazz Festival. So she's able to get him in there. And he probably credits her for helping him to get in there. But in terms of like his fame, he became well known in the UK when he appeared in Prime Suspect 2 in 1992. And he was DS Robert Oswald. And he's had an amazing TV and film career, really. His big roles include the first Resident Evil film. He's in Alien vs. Predator. He was in the TV series Bad Girls. He was in Doctor Who, Punisher Warzone. He's in the TV series Spooks. He's done another Resident Evil film as well. He's in Arrow, the TV series, in Law and Order UK. He's in 24. And then Silent Witness, Krypton, Intelligence. And then movies-wise, more recently, London Has Fallen and Mortal Engines. So he's a very in-demand actor. He has sort of reprised Bond a little bit in 2012 when Sky launched the 007 HD channel. He voiced the idents, and they're really good, actually. You can watch them again on YouTube. But bringing it back to Bond, like Robert Davi in License to Kill, Colin Salmon would often be called upon to do screen tests with other characters for the Bond films that he worked on. And he would often stand in as Bond against other Bond, the Bond girls, the Bond villains, that sort of thing, as sort of a chemistry thing. So he's played Bond in his own way. And there was a lot of talk at the time, I remember, of Colin Salmon being the next James Bond. When Pierce Brosnan was Bond, it was always Colin Salmon might be. He's like the Idris Elba of the Brosnan era, isn't he? And in fact, when Brosnan left the role in 2005, he was asked about who the next Bond should be. He said, "I think Gerard Butler would be great. Colin Salmon would be brilliant, but they don't have the bottle." Mm-hmm. And in response, Salmon said, "It's the ultimate accolade. There are some great candidates out there, but Pierce has watched me do it 5 or 6 screen tests and he knows I can do it." And then later, Daniel Craig got the role, obviously, and he was asked about it again. He said, "People have been betting about me being the next Bond for some time, so we'll see how it goes. There isn't a young man on the planet who wouldn't like to be Bond. I'm not holding my breath, but the response of the British public has been heartening." His Bond, he said, would be somewhere between Daniel Craig and Pierce Brosnan. I like what they've both done. So Colin Salmon, a nearly Bond who's in the Bond films. It's quite a rare occurrence.
I really like Robinson there. Interesting that they didn't just recast Tanner. Why didn't he just play Tanner?
Yeah, that's true. I guess Michael Kitchen was probably a recognisable face.
Yeah. Well, they've done it before, haven't they? They could have just done that. But that's he's like a precursor to Villiers, isn't he? I guess.
Right, let's move on.
R is for Romanova, Tatiana Romanova. So we've had the first Bond girl, and now we've got the second Bond girl, played by Daniela Bianchi. She's the Bond girl for From Russia with Love, and the main plot point, really. She is working for the Soviet army. She's a clerk in the consulate in Istanbul, who then is recruited by Rosa Klebb. But she doesn't know that Rosa Klebb works for Spectre and basically manipulates her, says her life depends on this mission. And the mission is to basically pretend she's in love with Bond and to get the Lecter. So she's basically they're just using her in this. She does help Bond obtain the Lecter and then she escapes with him and they're on the Orient Express on the way to Italy. But by this point, she is conflicted by her feelings that were false at the beginning are now growing into real feelings for Bond. But then she's scared of Kleb, and she is loyal to her country. So you've got Bond confronts her after Karen Bay is killed on the train, because he thinks that basically she was involved. But then she says she had nothing to do with it, and it was actually Red Grant that did it. So she is telling the truth and undeservedly gets problematically hit.
A wallop around the chops.
So after that, after Grant is killed, James Bond goes with Tatiana to Venice, and Rosa Klebb comes in disguised as a maid, tries to kill Bond with the knife shoes. And this is where you see that real test for Tatiana. She's got to decide where in that split second, which way to go. So she, in the end, she disarms Klebb, picks up the gun, and she's made her choice. And then the film ends with them on a boat through Venice, and then Bond throws the tape of them having sex in the canal. Tatiana is played by Daniela Bianchi. Now, over 200 actresses from around the world auditioned for this, which is incredible, isn't it? Yeah. And Terence Young, the director, he picked her from a headshot because he was ill and couldn't make the audition. So Terence Young and Cubby Broccoli, they had an appointment with Daniela at her home, and she performed the initial audition reading from her own bed. And she did perform that scene, the famous scene in the film. So after that successful first audition, she went back to Pinewood so the producers could make a decision on the casting, and she could do the scene properly, that scene with Anthony Dawson playing Bond.
Ooh.
Yeah.
It was in the first film.
He was Professor
Dent.
Dent, yeah.
You've had your
six. Yeah.
Yeah. Not quite the suave Bond who I want.
But she said, I was so excited during the first week of waiting that I couldn't sleep. Then when 2 and 3 weeks passed, I began to lose hope. But then they called me back to London for further tests with new makeup and hairstyle. My spirits zoomed again. So they narrowed it down to three actors for the role, and she got it. During the filming of From Russia With Love, her driver on the way to the set, they had a 6 a.m. shoot, he crashed the car and they fell 15 feet. So luckily she escaped, but she was quite badly bruised. And that meant the shooting schedule had to be delayed by 2 weeks for her face to heal. So there you go. So Daniela Bianchi, she was born in Rome, and she was the runner-up in the 1960 Miss Universe contest. And she was also voted Miss Photogenic by the press. Also in that same year, Aliza Gur was Miss Israel of 1960 and was a semi-finalist in the Miss Universe pageant. And she played Vida in From Russia With Love, one of the gypsy
girls, yeah.
Yeah. Incredibly, just a little side note here, Miss Universe is still going. I thought that would be canned, but no, it's still a thing. So in terms of her film career, she began in 1958. But here we go with dubbing again. In From Russia With Love, she was dubbed by Barbara Jefford because she had such a heavy accent. They had to redub Bianchi. But after From Russia With Love, she starred in some French and Italian films. The last one in 1968. In 1970, she actually retired because she married a shipping magnate called Alberto Camilli. So she just, I guess she didn't need to do it anymore or whatever. But yeah, she retired in 1970. One of her other films was Operation Kid Brother.
Yay.
OK Connery. The James Bond spoof starring Neil Connery, Sean's brother. Bianchi was dubbed in this as well. So we've never actually heard her real voice in a Bond film. In 2012, she was in a documentary called We're Nothing Like James Bond, which is an Italian documentary, and it's about two middle-aged Italian men, over 50, and they're just making a documentary to salute the invincible early Bond. So in this, they go to a Roman restaurant with Daniela Bianchi, and she sends them on the trail of Sean Connery. And so they do track him down, and they get some advice over the phone from him. But yeah, so that's Daniela Bianchi. But again, another iconic Bond woman.
I think the thing with Tatiana and Daniela's performance is it's very natural. It feels like sometimes you get the Bond girls or the female characters, and they're almost like heightened, like they have to sort of match up to the fantasy of the film.
Yeah.
Whereas I think Tatiana, she's a sort of an ordinary-ish person that gets dragged into this spy world, and that's something I don't think we get so much of anymore in Bond. I'd quite like to see, you know, Bond paired with someone like, you know, a regular person.
I think Vesper.
Yeah, but she's also a spy, right? She's also like works for the Secret Service. You look at Madeleine Swann, she's like the daughter of Spectre, she's a doctor, she's very glamorous, you know, all this sort of stuff. Yeah. And I think if you go back, maybe, I don't know, maybe Quantum of Solace. I mean, we're talking about Daniel Craig era here, but like it's something that you don't really see that often in the rest of the Bond world either. You know, it's not either someone's connected to a master criminal or, you know, Agent Triple X, they're a secret agent themselves. But Tatiana, although she's working for the KGB, she's a clerk. And there's a charming innocence about that, that I think, you know, the bit that always makes me laugh is where she makes a little mustache with her hair when she's like chatting with Bond. Do you know what I mean? It's like it's playful flirting. There's an innocence to it. And I think she's great. Art is for Russian. Charles Rushon. I think it's Rushon. I'm going to go with Rushon. Charles Rushon. Now, he's another name from behind the scenes of Bond. It may not be instantly recognisable if you only have a passing interest in the films, but he definitely played a big part in the series early on and was known by Roger Moore as Mr. Fix-It, and I'll explain why. So Charles Rushon, he was born in 1911, later died in 1982, but he was a US Army colonel who became involved with the James Bond films from 1963's From Russia With Love onwards. So prior to World War II, he had been a sound engineer working for NBC in New York and then for a Hollywood studio which specialised in Westerns called Republic Pictures. When World War II broke out, he joined the US Air Force and he worked in photo recon, and he actually received the British Distinguished Flying Cross for his actions in World War II. He was working with a top secret special operations team, the First Air Commando Group, during World War II. One of the most famous things he did was after the atomic bombs in Japan, he was among the first Americans on location flying over and documenting the destruction. So that was his big claim to fame. But after the war, he became a technical advisor to filmmakers using his experience from the military, obviously having known cameras and airplanes. And he sort of was very well connected. And he knew Cubby Broccoli before Cubby started working on the Bond film. So they knew each other. And so when Cubby needed someone to help sort stuff out for them, Charles Rushon was a guy that he turned to, particularly in America, but also in From Russia With Love. Charles Rushon negotiated with Turkish authorities for them to be able to use Istanbul as a location. So he became very important to the films. In Goldfinger, Cubby called upon Charles's acquaintance with JFK's press secretary, Pierre Salinger, and that was how they were able to gain access to film at Fort Knox. Rushon also was able to arrange for the US military to do those scenes where the soldiers are dropping to their knees when the gas is like being dropped. He helped organize all of that. And in recognition of his larger than life presence on set, when they fly to the Fort Knox hangar, there's a big sign in the movie that says "Welcome, General Rushon." So that's a little Easter egg for the filmmakers there in there. In Thunderball, in the next film, Rushon actually gets in a part in the film. He is the agent sat next to M in the sequence where all the secret agents are called together to respond to the Thunderball threat. So he's in that scene, but he's not just in the film. He also helped to, he arranged for the paratroopers dropping into the water at the end, you know, in jump into the diving scene. He arranged for all of that. So they filmed a water training jump to be filmed to put into the movie. He procured from the military or from entrepreneurs the jetpack and the skyhook to be used in the film. And he also arranged for the explosives that were used to blow up the Disco Volante ship. They actually used some sort of crazy like jet fuel, and it ended up blowing up windows 60 miles away. And he also, a lot of the underwater equipment in the film was arranged by Charles Rushon. $92,000 worth of underwater equipment, apparently. For his services on the film, Cubby gave him the motorbike that's used in the chase sequence in the film. So he got that and passed it on to his son. Now, in You Only Live Twice, he flew out with the film crew to Japan, back to where he shot the footage of the atomic bombs. And his wife, in an interview later, said, "In preparing for the Bond filming, there was a reception for the Japanese officials at which a gentleman greeted Charles and said, 'You've gained weight.' And it was a Japanese general who explained that he was on the welcoming committee at the Atsugi Air Base in Japan when the first plane arrived after the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and Charles stepped off." So he was able to reconnect with this Japanese military guy. And on that film, he also helped to bring... on the way back from Japan to the UK, he helped them to bring back the gyrojet rocketeer guns. Now, that's quite a distinctive gun they use in You Only Live Twice. You'd have to look it up, but you'll know it when you see it. It's got like holes in the side. So he worked out with that as well. And then his work extended into the Roger Moore era as well. And one of the most famous things that he gets credit for is closing down FDR Drive in New York for the scene where Bond is driving across New York, and Roger Moore called him Mr. Fix-It because he seemed to be able to do or get anything done in New York City. So that's Charles Rushon. So again, a bit of an unknown name, but quite an important one.
Yeah, some of the films would look quite different without him.
Definitely. I mean, that Thunderball, yeah. All those gadgets that he brought in, I thought they were just made up for the film, but no, he was instrumental in bringing them in. Which is brilliant. So we're going to dive into the addendum here. I've got to add a quick one to the list, Brendan, because I have a bit of an oversight.
No.
I know. But John Richardson, he wasn't on the list originally, but I've added him in. He's a British special effects supervisor. He's worked on hundreds and hundreds of films, including 9 James Bond films, Casino Royale 67, Moonraker, Octopussy, View to a Kill, Living Daylights, License to Kill, Tomorrow Never Dies, The World Is Not Enough, and Die Another Day. And he's actually been nominated for 5 Oscars, and he won one for his work on Aliens. And he's been nominated for 9 BAFTAs, winning one for Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2. But I mean, he's a massive name in British film industry. His credits include Men in Black 2, Deep Blue Sea, Starship Troopers, Cliffhanger, Highlander 2, Willow, the Pink Panther films. And in 2019, he released a book called Making Movie Magic, A Lifetime Creating Special Effects. And we're hoping, fingers crossed, that we'll get to speak to John Richardson for the podcast and talk to him about his amazing career. But who else do we need to give an honourable mention to in the letter R, Brendan?
So we have Simon Raven, who was a writer. Well, he was an additional writer on Her Majesty's Secret Service. He was an author, playwright, television writer and screenwriter. And according to Peter Hunt, he brought him on board to make the dialogue better and a little sharper and more intellectual. And he specifically pinpoints the scene between Tracy and Blofeld, and a lot of the Piz Gloria dialogue is apparently where Raven's work went. So a lot of brushing up, which we've seen a lot over the years, haven't we? You know, these writers who come in and just give it a nice bit of polish or add an extra layer for the dialogue.
Sometimes it's needed, isn't it? But those scenes in Piz Gloria between Blofeld and Tracy are some of the best. You know, when he's reciting that poem and she recites one back, and it is dazzling stuff. So a great contribution.
Yeah,
from Simon Raven. Who else to mention? Reynard.
I can't believe it's just Addendum.
I'm sorry. I'm really sorry. We will cover Reynard in The World Is Not Enough. That is an episode that is coming up very soon. So stay tuned for that one. But Reynard is the character in World Is Not Enough, played by Robert Carlyle. He's a terrorist who conspires with Elektra to monopolize the world's oil market. I can't remember what the plot of that film is, but that's basically the gist of it. And his shtick is that he can't feel pain. He's got a bullet lodged in his brain.
He holds hot rocks.
And the character's name is actually Victor Zocas, but he's known as Reynard the Fox, which is the French word for fox. So
that's another Z we could have had.
Well, yeah. So his backstory is basically he was in the military, and then he was an assassin for the KGB, and then he was kicked out of the KGB because he was mentally unstable. But he gets into cahoots with Elektra King after he kidnaps her. So, I mean, Robert Carlyle basically joined this film at the height of his Trainspotting and Full Monty fame. Mm. And we'll talk about other people who were considered for the role when we cover The World Is Not Enough. But one interesting fact about it was that Robert Carlyle, while he was making the film, was awarded an OBE, and the Queen asked him what he was doing at the moment. And he said, "I spent the whole day trying to kill James Bond." So... there you go.
So Claude Renoir, he was a French cinematographer. He was the son of actor Pierre Renoir, who's nephew of a director, Jean Renoir, and the grandson of painter Pierre Auguste Renoir.
The Renoir dynasty.
Yes, exactly. And he was born in Paris. And he worked on films. He worked on Cleopatra. He worked on Barbarella. And he also was a cinematographer on The Spy Who Loved Me. So that's how we get to him. But he's quite well renowned for having the people who talk about his work. They say that he's got like a painter's eye.
Well, they would say that, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
Easy.
Yeah, it's easy. Yeah.
Easy shorthand, isn't it?
towards his final years, he actually went almost completely blind as well, sadly.
But he was going to be on Moonraker, I think, and they he couldn't do it because of that. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's why we got the, I can't remember who replaced him. Another French cinematographer, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
And also cinematographer Michael Reed, born 1929. Canadian, British, who worked on a lot of films throughout the 60s and 70s. And he was second unit director of photography on Goldfinger, Thunderball, and You Only Live Twice. He also worked on The Saint. He did 21 episodes of that with Roger Moore. Did some Hammer horror. And then eventually he graduated and became the director of photography on Her Majesty's Secret Service. So that's, another cinematographer there.
And let's wrap things up then with a couple of actors. I love it when we find actors who've been in multiple Bond films playing different characters. It's one of life's little pleasures. So please indulge me for a second while I tell you about Shane Rimmer and George Rubicek. So Shane Rimmer, you may know the name, but he was a Canadian actor born in 1929, died in 2019. He spent most of his career working in the UK, and he called himself Rent-A-Yank because basically in British film or TV, if you ever need an American actor, they called on this Canadian guy. So he basically carved out a very, very productive niche playing American roles in British TV and film over 50 years. Best known though for voicing Scott Tracy in Thunderbirds. But Rimmer appeared in Bond films a number of times. He played the radar operator in You Only Live Twice, who's tracking down, I think it's the spaceship, I think, right at the beginning. He plays Tom in Willard White's factory in Diamonds Are Forever. So when it's Klaus Hergesheimer time, he's in there. And when he talks about meeting Connery, he said, "I remember shaking in my shoes with the first sight I had of Connery because he had this amazing, forceful personality." He then dubs an actor or a character in Live and Let Die. but he got his biggest screen role in Bond playing Commander Carter in The Spy Who Loved Me, one of the submarine captains who is taken hostage and helps take down the bad guy at the end of that movie. But he talks about The Spy Who Loved Me. He said, "Oh, I remember almost getting killed when they overdid an explosion near me. It must have been a young guy trying to get his credentials overnight to become a star. After the ceiling started to come down, I just followed Roger as if anybody was going to get out of there safe. He was." So yeah, that was that. He said there was half a dozen had to be treated for pretty bad burns. It was quite a terrible situation. Great. But talking about Roger, he said Roger was tremendously helpful and charming. He must have been the director's greatest friend. There was never any controversy when Roger was involved. He liked to tease the director occasionally. I can't think of a particular incident, but he just kept things moving in good spirits and never took things too seriously. So that Roger all over. Rimmer also appeared in Doctor Strange Love. He's in Star Wars, the original Star Wars. He was in Batman Begins. And he's also played three different characters in the first three Superman films. So very much a recognisable face across that sort of era of movies. And my final one, George Rubicek. He's an Austrian actor and a dialogue director and a script adapter for English language versions of foreign films and television shows. And he appeared in two James Bond films. He was one of the astronauts in You Only Live Twice. So nice little link there to Shane Rimmer. And then in The Spy Who Loved Me, he was a captain of a Russian submarine, the Stromberg 1, which was originally the Potemkin, but then became the Stromberg 1. So there you go. Nice little link to Shane Rimmer there as well. Mm. He appeared in the first Star Wars film. You'll recognise him as soon as you look at him in Star Wars, you'll say, "Ah, I remember that guy." He has a conversation with Darth Vader. And then he obviously was in Doctor Who, Dad's Army. And other credits include Billion Dollar Brain and The Dirty Dozen. But yeah, another one under the letter R that we couldn't let go without mentioning. So I think that wraps up our episode on the letter R.
There we go.
There are no Bond movies under the letter R. So it's just a short stop in this letter of the alphabet. But what's next? The letter S.
S. Oh, that's meaty, isn't it?
We've got some good ones. Yeah, a lot of people under the letter S. So we might have to make a two-part for the letter episodes. But yeah, we've also got movie episodes to come. Skyfall and Spectre, back to back.
Mm.
And, of course, one of the big creatives of the Bond world that we haven't covered in detail yet, so I'm really looking forward to, Harry Saltzman.
Ah, of course. Yes.
So I'm really looking forward to getting stuck into that. But in the meantime, we are still looking for your underappreciated movie moments from the James Bond films for our 60th anniversary special episodes. Tell us what that moment is. It can be anything. It can be a song. It can be a character. It can be a gadget, a pigeon, a bondler. It can be an actor that's appeared in multiple Bond films like Shane Rimmer.
Yeah.
It could be Burt Kwok. It could be anything. Yeah. Let us know who you are, what your favourite moment is. On an audio clip, send it to podcast@jamesbond.co.uk, as well as your feedback for this episode. And if people want to get us on social media, Brendan, how can they find us?
@JamesBondA to Z on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
And please, as always, if you enjoyed this podcast and you've enjoyed what you've listened to, then please leave us a rating on your podcast app of choice. And that all always helps to raise the profile. So without further ado, it just remains for me to say that the James Bond A to Z podcast will return next week.
Ciao.
The James Bond A to Z podcast is hosted and produced by Tom Butler and Brendan Duffy, with music by Tom Ingemels and artwork by Helene Dolly. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Thanks for listening.
Helps if you open the door.
And you might be... This is 007.
If you're Q, does that make him R?
Ah, yes, the legendary 007 wit. Or at least half of it. Now, I dare say, 007, that you've met your match with this machine.
Yeah, new model, improved specs.
I thought you were on the inactive roster, some kind of injury.
Yes, well, we'll see about that, so...
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.